2 präsentiert Hörspielpool. Große Produktionen zum Herunterladen. Mehr Informationen unter www.bayern2.de. Bayern 2. Hörbar mehr vom Leben.
Föhrenallee, Pennsylvania Straße, Faulhaber Straße. Saarpfalz Straße, New Jersey Straße, Corbinian Straße. Memeler Straße, New York Straße, Rupert Straße. Lothringer Straße, Indiana Straße, Dekanweis Straße. Adolf Hitler Platz, Roosevelt Square, Seminarplatz.
The camp that was easiest to get to from Munich was Föhrenwald, I think. You took the Isartal train to Wolfratshausen, and from there you went by taxi to Föhrenwald. These weren't German taxis, but taxis from the camp. You had to arrange to be picked up. There were some private cabs too, usually basic Opels, that drove to the camp from Mühlstraße in Munich. The Central Committee was located on Mühlstraße, as were the relief organizations, the American Joint Distribution Committee, the Jewish Agency, and other Jewish organizations. If you wanted to know what was going on in the world, to find out whether someone was still alive, and if so, where, you had to come to Mühlstraße. It was the main point of contact.
When we got to Föhrenwald, a group was taken from the kitchen to our allocated accommodation. Survivors of all ages dressed in ragged clothes or concentration camp uniforms passed by us. The people who had arrived before us invited us into their overcrowded quarters. That first night we exchanged lots of information about the death camps and discovered that so far no one had been moved on from Camp Föhrenwald. So our stay here wouldn't be over tomorrow. Maybe not next week or next month either, which wasn't what we had expected.
Over there was the open house, which was called that because children and young people could go there at any time. There were games and handicraft materials you could use, or you could play table tennis. Behind the house was a large field where we played football or Völkerball, a game similar to dodgeball. And there were always helpers on hand. It was a popular meeting place.
Over here on the corner was the hairdressing salon. It was one room with two chairs and two hairdressers, who cut and styled people's hair. In the other room, on the first floor, lived a woman called Hella, a small, energetic person who tried to earn some money by running a small cook store, where you could buy warm food, soup or a snack. This was New Jersey Straße, although in those days we called it Neviazi, because we couldn't speak English. It was a very popular street, as it was right in the center of the camp.
The language of the camp was Yiddish. Everyone spoke Yiddish. In the place where the church is now, there used to be a cinema. I know that because my parents ran the candy booth there and always left me alone in the evenings. There were cultural events too. We did sometimes hear that there were problems with the authorities. Life in the camp was not without problems.
Once a week on Sundays, there was a big market where you could buy anything and everything, new and second-hand goods plus chickens and geese. It looked just like you used to see it in pictures. And then there were the bagel sellers, street traders who sold freshly baked bagels in front of our house and in lots of other places throughout the camp. They lived and worked in the camp and in that way probably supplemented their income a bit. Inside the camp, there were also several general stores, small shops where you could buy everyday necessities. Then there were fruit and vegetable stores, and I remember at least one bakery. We often took the Cholent there on Fridays. The food was placed in a huge oven in the cellar where it stayed warm and was brought out again on the Saturday when it was forbidden to cook in time for lunch.
In the Florida bar behind the synagogue, On the corner of Wisconsin Straße and Florida Straße, there was coffee and soda, and also the first gaming machines. That's also where the food depot was, where you exchanged food ration coupons for basic foodstuffs and milk.
We lived at number 54 New Jersey Straße, that was in 1952. There was a variety of courses on offer at the Ort School, the vocational school. You could learn dressmaking or train to become a beautician. And for the men, there were courses in electrical installation, joinery, and various other skilled craft trades. We also celebrated huge weddings in the school. Half the camp would be there, a good few hundred people. We had our own rabbi and our own circumciser. Camp Föhrenwald was a real Jewish shtetl. Our whole life basically took place out of doors. Those really were wonderful days. I'll never forget the time I spent there.
It was important that people first of all got together with their own kind. You couldn't go back to your native land because there was nothing left there. The families were no longer there. You had to join together as a group because then you had more weight politically than if individual people went off to live in all different places. You had to get organized. All those people who arrived here in 1945-46 expected that the world would get behind them to make sure that their situation was immediately improved after having suffered such appalling atrocities, that they would receive every conceivable form of assistance from the international community. Uprooted, completely deprived of your rights, both socially and politically, you were basically powerless, so you had to make the best of it on your own.
The children were pretty tough. They walked around barefoot in the snow just like the adults. There was no central heating, contrary to what was claimed in one book, nor was there any hot water. When you entered the small house, first of all there was a toilet, then a small living room, then a long narrow room with two stone sinks where we washed ourselves or did laundry, and in the summer we kept food cool there.
31st of December 1945, the American military government requires that the district administration supply a number of additional articles for Camp Föhrenwald. The following goods are to be provided: 5 sewing machines, 10 electric irons, 1,000 pictures, 250 wooden beds, 70 baby bars, 70 cradles, 50 thimbles, 50 tape measures, a large quantity of light bulbs and other electrical goods. It is further to be noted that all goods, including those confiscated previously in the orders of the military government, are to be paid for by the Chief Administrative Officer.
I came to Munich in November 1945. When the war ended, I immediately got in touch with members of Bricha, a Zionist underground organization. Bricha is a Hebrew word that means escape, because the aim was to get as many Jews as possible to Palestine. I had survived as a partisan in a huge forest area on the border between Poland and White Russia. Bricha sent me to Munich as an intermediary. For the Jews, Munich was the most important city in the whole of Europe. It was in the American-occupied zone, and from here it was possible to immigrate to North or South America, to Australia, and above all, to Palestine. Munich was the gateway to the rest of the world.
I had fled from the concentration camp wearing a striped prison uniform. If we hadn't organized things ourselves, we might not have gotten anything else to wear all year and would have had to have gone about dressed in those prison clothes. Then we got second-hand clothing. We got our provisions from the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration, plus some additional rations from Jewish American relief organizations. In many camps, there were also joint field workers who helped with the administration and distribution of aid. We looked upon our life in the DP camp in Germany as a period of preparation for emigration. No one, not a single person here, would have dreamt of staying on.
It was obviously the case that those people who had never been in Germany before, and that was a majority, were not seeking to spend their future here. For them, the DP camp represented a transitional stage on the journey to a new life away from the perpetrators. In America, Israel, South America, or Sweden, anywhere but here. What the Jews wanted was what the Nazis didn't quite accomplish, a Germany where there are no Jews.
Everyone lived with their suitcases packed. The goal was emigration. A lot of people were waiting for the day when Israel would become an independent state in Palestine. Many left to join the struggle for liberation. There were posters saying that any young people who could bear arms should report immediately. Those who did were smuggled to Palestine, which was under English blockade. I knew the routes that were taken. I was directly involved.
After the war, we wanted to emigrate to America. But then only applications from displaced persons from Germany were being processed. On May 14, 1948, the State of Israel was founded, and we hoped to find a new homeland there. On May 15th, however, troops from the neighboring Arab nations invaded the Jewish settlements. We were reluctant to go to a war zone because we had two young children. So our plan to emigrate fell through, and we got stuck in Germany.
The large majority of Jewish DPs didn't want to stay in Germany, nor did they want to return to Eastern Europe. Unlike the survivors from the period immediately after the war, among whom there were few children or old people, these were families with grandparents and grandchildren. They weren't welcome in Germany, the surviving remnant, as they called themselves. They were referred to not as survivors, as people who had escaped elimination, but as foreigners, as aliens.
At the beginning of October 1945, there were already 2,000 people in the camp, about one-third of them children. At the end of October, 1,080 East European Jews arrive in Föhrenwald. At that point, 3,000 Jews are living in Föhrenwald. In January 1946, the number has already increased to 5,300. Föhrenwald has the highest birth rate of any Jewish community in the world.
Compared to other camps, which consist mainly of badly insulated barracks, the workers' housing development in Föhrenwald offers good living conditions. The American military government announces that Föhrenwald is to become a center for Jewish children and young people on the strength of its good physical structures and furnishings.
In 1946, they were looking for another midwife to work in Föhrenwald. That's how I came there, as a Red Cross midwife. At that time, there were three midwives, myself included, working in Föhrenwald. When you went around the camp, it looked like every young woman in the camp was pregnant. Sometimes there were 12 babies in one cot. Our accommodation was, of course, fairly basic. We were put up in the attic of one of the small houses in Föhrenwald. It was a largish room, divided off with cupboards and blankets. I had nothing but a bed, a bedside table, and an army locker. Apart from me, there was a mother and her son from Danzig, and a woman with her niece also lived there. I didn't see much of the other camp inhabitants, just the patients, the women, then their babies and the men, if and when they came. On the eighth day, I got the little boys ready for circumcision. There were only men present at the circumcision, and me. On Saturdays, the rabbis were there too. "What's she doing here?" they would ask the circumciser. "That's the midwife. She gets the children ready." That meant it was acceptable for me, a Christian, to be present at the ceremony.
I came to Föhrenwald two or three times a month, whenever I wanted to eat in a Jewish restaurant, because it was obligatory to have a school, a sports club, and a restaurant. And the people used them all. When I went to visit my friends on Saturdays, they always had the table laid, usually with a chicken and a few eggs, soup, bread, etc. The houses were decent enough, although it really was pretty cramped. Three families in one little house. However, the houses were in a good state. Some of them had bathrooms with cold running water or central heating.
They were terraced houses, and during the period of residence, their condition never changed. No one who moved out ever redecorated for the next inhabitants. The rooms were furnished, since no one had any furniture. We had all been loaded onto trucks and taken from one camp to the next. We slept on those army folding beds that can be completely folded up. Then there was a table, a few chairs, and a stove. We were five people to a room, but the room was divided into two with a pasteboard wall to make a parents' room and a combined children's room, living room, dining room, bathroom, and playroom. It was a kind of partial terraced house. Downstairs was one family who had two rooms and the toilet, which we shared. Also downstairs was a washroom with cold running water, more for washing clothes than anything else. On each floor there was a stove to cook on. To wash yourself, you went to the public baths in the center of the camp by the small square with a flagpole opposite the administration building. Once a week on Fridays, you could take a shower there, and there were bathtubs too, upstairs for the men, downstairs for the women.
Here I think it would be interesting to mention the bathhouse attendant. He was one of the few non-Jews employed in the camp. He looked after the bathhouse. He was a slim, gaunt-faced man of very few words who chain-smoked cigarettes, but didn't stand out apart from that. He had very little to do with the people in the camp. However, when he got sick and had to go to hospital, they found an SS sign tattooed in his armpit. This former SS man must have felt very safe here under cover of the DP camp, and so had spent the post-war years in Föhrenwald.
Of course, for the older people, Föhrenwald was above all just one more camp. You didn't know if you would be there one more day, or another 100 days, one more year or another 10 years. There was nothing to do there. You were always just waiting for something to happen that never did. People were constantly depressed. After all, these were survivors from the concentration camps, the ghettos and the forests.
We could sense that these were very special people, people with numbers on their forearms who had had dreadful things happen to them.
A small, pleasant man called the consul, who couldn't read or write, acted as a messenger for the camp administration and delivered the mail, the official communications. Everyone was always waiting for him to arrive, because he was the one who brought the good news when someone could emigrate. So when he knocked on the door, you were always happy.
Danzige Freiheit, Independence Place. Kolpingplatz, Elsässerstraße, Illinoisstraße, Andreasstraße, Adolf-Hitler-Platz, Roosevelt Square, Seminarplatz, Sudetenstraße, Ohio-Straße, Wildenstraße, Steirerstraße, Bleudestraße, Gebsattelstraße.
At some point during 1938, the landowners were informed in a meeting in the town hall that their properties were required and that they may never set foot in them again. A high fence was put up, and in 1940 that became Camp Föhrenwald, stone barracks intended to house 4,500 unmarried workers.
I saw people go off to work in the chocolate factory. Of course, I know now that they were taken to the munitions factories. We children always waited in hope that one day they would bring back some chocolate.
On Saturdays and Sundays, you hardly heard a word of German on the streets or saw a German face. People's clothing, their behavior, all very uninhibited. On Marktstraße, you often saw couples hugging and kissing each other demonstrably in front of everyone. The cinema, the circus and carousels made regular appearances here and were very popular. The excessive makeup worn by the French women, with their brightly painted lips, white faces, and plucked eyebrows, had a sobering effect on the German women, who no longer used any makeup. Attendance at church was very poor among the foreigners. 40 French women and 20 Italians at most.
The map of the area shows it was a combined enterprise, as several thousand male and female members of the workforce have to be accommodated here. The segregation of camp residents according to sex is achieved by the positioning of an axial street and low wooden fences. All of the camp's facilities are installed and operational and show the living conditions of German workers in the Reich. The facility was built in the foothills of the Alps, close to a river on near-level forest ground, preserving as much as possible of the original tree stock created the visual impression of a place that has developed organically. In view of current events, streets and squares have been named after regained territories. The terrain is entirely surrounded by a fence made of wire and wood, in order to make surveillance and control of the camp easier for the guards on duty at the gate.
In 1942, I was deported to Germany as a forced laborer. I worked in a chemical plant, a munitions factory where parts for rifles, cartridges, and fittings for bombers were made. The plant was located in the forest, and the camp was about 10 minutes away from it by train. It was called Camp Föhrenwald. I worked in the armaments factory, in the section where the yellow powder was dried. There were other sections too, but it was prohibited to go into them. Accidents often took place because of that yellow powder.
The women workers' faces and hands had gone a yellowish color from being in contact with the chemical substances. Even their hair was yellow. We used to call them the canaries.
I was drafted into military service and came to Camp Föhrenwald that way. We lived on Steirer Straße. The whole of Steirer Straße was filled with girls from the labor service who traveled to the plant by factory train. Anyway, we lived in a house in the camp. The upstairs floors of the houses hadn't been partitioned off yet. There was just one single room with 8 beds, 4 bunk beds. The partitions must have been put in later for the Jews. Usually 14 to 16 people lived in one house, about 8 on the first floor and the rest upstairs. Nowadays, a family of 4 would find these houses cramped. But it was still well kept somehow. There were nice streets. It wasn't dirty.
The majority of the workers, who were very often made to work here against their will, lived in Camp Föhrenwald. Amongst others, there were several hundred French women, several hundred French men, Belgians, Czechs, Slovaks, Ukrainians, Croats, Spaniards, Dutch, and Italians. The signs in the camp were posted in 15 different languages.
All the houses looked the same in the camp. Each street contained between 2 and 8 houses in a row. There were hardly any freestanding houses, except for the gatehouse at the entrance to the camp. The houses were all painted with camouflage paint and had equally inconspicuous roof tiles.
At the center of the street's arrangement is a large communal building by the parade ground. It houses a men's dining room measuring 60 by 20 meters and a women's dining room measuring 50 by 18 meters. A stage has been installed along with a cinema screen for social and cultural events organized by Kraft durch Freude. Lectures are broadcast via the radio control center and loudspeakers to the dining rooms and to all the accommodation buildings, which also make it possible to raise the alarm across the whole camp. The camp fire brigade provides effective fire protection by means of a motor pump, portable fire extinguishers, rainwater mains with pillar hydrants, and a fire water pump. A large sports field serves the purposes of physical training. A well-stocked library contains a wide selection of reading material on all subjects.
In the mornings and evenings, meals were provided for all the camp residents in the large main building on Adolf Hitler Platz. Cooking in the rooms was not permitted. In the dining room, the conscripts sat at the front next to the stage, and the foreign workers sat at the back. There was real segregation. The foreign workers didn't live in as good conditions as we did. Even the food we got was much better than theirs. But you didn't really hear much about them or see them. Maybe we worked different shifts. The people in the camp were separated according to sex and nationality. The French and the Italian women, the Russians, the Czechs. We weren't allowed to talk to them at all.
Every factory worker had a special identity card, which allowed him or her to leave Camp Föhrenwald through the gate and enter the factory premises of Deutsche Dynamit AG. At the gate, there were two guards' cabins with armed guard detachments who inspected and checked every worker and frisked them for explosives. Smokers had to lock their cigarettes and matches away in lockers at the gate. One spark would have been enough to blow up the munitions factory and the camp.
When I heard that the Americans were coming, I was off. But I saw the wretched procession of survivors from Dachau concentration camp come into Camp Föhrenwald. Those people were on their last legs. They were nothing but skeletons. All they had was their prison clothes and a blanket. It was cold and there was snow on the ground. I peeled potatoes in the kitchen. The German chef soon ran off, but the conscripts were still here. The French were the first to leave. Six of us lived in the hairdressing salon. The hairdresser and his family had left everything behind. We made ourselves skirts from the curtains. Because we were in the salon, we had everything to hand. Irons, a stove and such like. Christel freshly ironed her dress every morning. When the camp became purely Jewish at Pentecost in 1945, we had to leave. Later on, my husband was an executive civil servant in the town hall, which meant he had to go to Camp Föhrenwald every 4 weeks to make payments to the residents. By then, the Jewish inhabitants were on public assistance. He had to go in through the guardhouse and was accompanied by an American. When we came back here in 1956, I got a real shock. It was awful. We saw how they lived. We had no contact with them. I was scared there were bugs in the house.
Luxemburger Straße, Michigan Straße, Wolfram Straße, Sudetenstraße, Tennessee Straße, Turing Straße, Wiener Straße, Wisconsin Straße, Quebec Straße, Kärntner Straße, Missouri Straße, Cher Straße, Tiroler Straße, Kentucky Straße, Steichele Straße.
I remember Föhrenwald in black and white. The ground was covered in sand, just gravel and stones, not a patch of green.
The people in the camp had time on their hands. Everybody in the camp knew everybody else, and anyone who went out or came in through the gate was observed.
The people from Föhrenwald were allowed to leave the camp. It was embarrassing, because people outside used to look at them and say, "Those are the ones from the concentration camp." You never stopped being the stranger.
For us, Föhrenwald was an island. It wasn't Germany.
I can't remember us having any contact to the local population. I think people also avoided us. The local German population disliked coming into the camp. They didn't try to establish contact, but neither did we. For us, the camp was like a ghetto, but we were very happy there. We had our own cinema, social events, our own annual ball, the Purim Ball. We staged our own theater productions, sometimes performing them in front of a few hundred people, and our troupe even went on tour to perform for the American troops. We had table tennis, our own soccer ground, and our own soccer club. We had our own police force, our own hospital, our own doctors. We had a youth club and a youth group. Youth work was under Jewish control, a variety of games and sporting events. Some very early memories I have are of the 1954 Soccer World Cup. Everyone was sitting on a bench outside. Somebody had put a TV set on the window ledge, and we were watching it from outside.
And then came the time when the other camps were closed, and the Americans handed over the administration of Föhrenwald to the German authorities. The closure of the other camps didn't meet with any resistance. But in Föhrenwald, there was clear resistance to the takeover by the German authorities. A German policeman at the gate. No way.
In the schoolyard, we used to play Who's Afraid of the Boogeyman? the Volksschule, was opened in 1952. From then on, the teachers were German, and they also taught us our first foreign language, German. Because up till then, we had learned everything in Yiddish. The curriculum covered the usual subjects. At first, there were two classes, one for the first to fourth grades and the other for the fifth to seventh grades. Later on, there were several classes. We had religious education in Yiddish in the story above the synagogue. At the age of 3 and a half, I was already in Cheder, the religious elementary school, where we were taught the alphabet, the Hebrew alphabet, and later also learned to read and translate the Bible.
Föhrenwald, November 1945. 27 teachers teach Hebrew, religion, Bible studies, English, mathematics, drawing and sport. 250 children attend the main Tarbut school. The Volksschule on Michiganstrasse.
From 1946 onwards, the Tarbut School offers high school courses in the following subjects: Hebrew, Jewish History, Palestine Studies, World History, English, Mathematics, Geography, Anthropology, Drawing, Music and Sport.
Munich, 27th of January, 1946. The first Congress of the Liberated Jews, also attended by David Ben-Gurion, is held in the town hall in Munich.
Föhrenwald, February 1946. Rabbi Halberstam founds a yeshiva where 150 rabbinical students devote themselves to the Holy Scriptures. The school is open day and night. Foundation of the religious Bet Yaakov School for 20 girls, New Jersey Strasse 48. Soon, 90 girls are being taught in three classes, which leads the school to being moved to New Jersey Strasse 8, founding of a religious kindergarten.
Föhrenwald, 1950. 250 children are looked after in 10 groups in the kindergarten on Michiganstrasse.
Vocational training program of the Organization for Rehabilitation Through Training. 15 teachers are being in charge of the instruction of 265 trainees and apprentices. Nursing training, courses in dressmaking or tailoring, radio technology and chauffeuring, apprenticeships to become metal workers, shoemakers, carpenters, electricians, hairdressers, watchmakers.
Practical preparation for life in Israel through agricultural training in two kibbutzim, Brit HaKael and Herzliya.
90% of the camp inhabitants have some form of occupation. They work as salaried employees, teachers, cleaners, policemen, firemen, woodworkers, drivers, motor mechanics, all photographers are employed in the kitchens, laundry or administration offices, are involved in organizing cultural activities or are school pupils or mothers.
Bamidbar Theatre Group, Mapilim Theatre Group, Bar Kokhba Theatre Group, Negev Theatre Group.
I know all the camps because I was the tour manager of the MIT, the Munich Jewish Theater. Through my theater work, I went to Föhrenwald, Landsberg, Feldafing, Bad Reichenhall, Eschwege, Zeilsheim near Frankfurt, Heidenheim, Bamberg, Amberg, Selb and Hof. We toured all the DP camps, anywhere with a hall that could hold 200 people. The joint gave us cars, GMCs for the theater group to use. They also served the purposes of illegal emigration. We drove as far as Salzburg or Innsbruck, crossing the border with the consent of the Allies, and from there people went illegally over the border to Italy. Then they made their way to the south of Italy, where small Italian boats brought the emigrants to Palestine.
Bamidbar, Wochenzeitung von die befreiten Jiden, was the name of our own camp newspaper. For the first issues, we didn't have enough typesetting materials to set the whole newspaper in Hebrew type. Yiddish is written in Hebrew script, which is why only the first and the last pages were set in Hebrew, and the rest was transcribed phonetically and set in Latinized type, following the grammar rules and orthography of Polish. We received the Hebrew letters from America. We were linked to the Jewish Telegraphic Agency and other news organizations. Our newspaper was very informative. We reported on events taking place all over the world, but also about what was happening in our and other DP camps. In Munich, the first issues of the Yiddish newspapers were printed on the printing press of the former Völkischer Beobachter newspaper. On October 12, 1945, the first issue of the Jewish national weekly newspaper Unser Weg appeared in Munich.
Bamidbar Camp Newspaper.
Library containing 700 volumes. Reading room with 40 newspapers from America, Palestine and Germany. Open day and night.
String orchestra and youth choir.
Camp cinema, 2 film screenings daily.
Jewish sports club, Maccabi, where the following sports are played. Football, gymnastics, boxing, skiing, basketball, athletics, table tennis, physical education.
6 synagogues.
Hospital with 150 beds, pharmacy, 3 doctors, 1 dentist, 1 dental technician, 4 nurses.
Camp court.
Political parties. Orthodox Agudat Party, Zionist Mizrahi Party, Socialist Hashomer Hatzair Party, Socialist Alliance.
Underground organizations. Haganah, military training, and Bricha, illegal immigration to Palestine.
It was also the case that the DP camps were centers of black marketeering. One reason for this was that they were extraterritorial institutions and therefore didn't come under the jurisdiction of the German criminal prosecution authorities. It must also be remembered that while we were provided with food enough to survive, that was all we were given. Anything else you needed, from a comb for your hair to the shoes on your feet, had to be acquired through exchange. The black market grew out of this bartering system.
At first, I didn't want to go into the camp because I was afraid of what the Jews might do to me after all their suffering, everything we had done to them. You could imagine what they would do to me if I, a German, were to enter the camp. But the Jews told me I didn't have to worry, that nothing would happen to me. And it is really true that in all the time I worked as a hairdresser in the camp, never a harsh word was spoken to me. Not even a suggestion. The people were always really nice, so warm-hearted and friendly. They were always giving me food and all sorts of other things, money too. They used to say, "Tell us what you need and we'll get it for you." We fixed a box onto my bicycle, which they also organized for me, so that I could get to the camp at all, and it was always completely full of things, sometimes more than we could use. I often felt almost embarrassed at being given so much. But without those things, we might have starved.
There were a few Orthodox Jews, Hasidim, with their payas, streimels and kaftans, who used to flit around the camp and were in charge of the religious teaching in Cheder. The rest were people like us, who weren't very religious. They just had more of a Jewish consciousness and awareness of being Jewish, unlike the Poles, Ukrainians or Russians. The mixture of people in the camp reflected the composition of the population in Eastern European countries before the war. They were townspeople, for the most part, workers, people from the lowest ranks of society who were marked by the struggle to survive. Religion didn't play a big part in their lives.
I remember the synagogues and the ritual bath for women. The Orthodox married women had cut off their hair and wore wigs or headscarves. In one street, almost every house was a TB clinic because there were so many TB patients. There were 2 hospitals in Föhrenwald. One was for women, with a surgical ward for men upstairs. In the other was the internal medicine department and X-ray department. All the medical apparatus was left over from the former reserve camp. In the street leading away from the hospital, there were many doctors, eye specialists, dermatologists, etc. Lots of Germans worked at the hospital in Föhrenwald. We were all happy to work there because you were given meals.
Unlike many other families in the camp, only a small number of DPs had strong religious beliefs. My mother kept a strictly kosher household. For her, it was a matter of course to use two sets of pots and pans and dishes, one for fleischig, which is meat, and the other for milchig, which is dairy dishes. In addition to those, we had special crockery for Passover. Because we only had a small amount of crockery and utensils, my mother spent a lot of time and energy cleaning them. I remember how she would burn out iron pots and pans on the stove in the small kitchen area to make them clean in accordance with the Kashrut.
In May 1946, my parents were able to buy the ruins of the Föhrenwald railway station. My father was employed in the disarmament process in the former munitions factory. At some point, the idea of opening a store was developed. There were very few sources of supplies. One of the initial ideas for our business came from the fact that some of the camp inhabitants needed new crockery for Passover. The store kept our head above water all those years. Otherwise, there wasn't much contact between the Jewish people in the camp and the non-Jews outside. There were simply too many reservations. Those inside the camp had understandable reasons to be reluctant, and those outside were somehow scared.
At the entrance, there was a guardhouse occupied by the American military police until 1952. Then the German police took over, but they didn't feel responsible for what happened in the camp. The American military police also left everything up to the elected Jewish police force. The military police were only called in when there was a serious problem. I remember once a whole truck full of military police came on a raid. Counterfeit money had been printed, military payment certificates. I remember how after carrying out the raid, the military policemen took a group photograph of themselves in the camp.
Shlomo dealt in cigarettes, tobacco and coffee. The people in the camp naturally showed solidarity with someone like Shlomo. He was given prior warning when news leaked out that the police would be showing up in the settlement. He was told to hide out in the forest while they were there. And what did he have in his house? Maybe 10 cartons of cigarettes and a few kilos of coffee. Everyone made sure he didn't get caught.
Sunday was market day. 30 to 40 stalls were put up on Auerbachstraße and New Jersey Straße. Ropes were hung between the stalls and the goods for sale were attached to them. Very high quality American linen sheets, bed linen, textiles, shoes, leather goods, tools, games, and all sorts of jumble.
In the beginning, the customers I had an appointment with would meet me at the gate, because the Americans didn't let just anyone enter the camp. But later, I was simply waved through. At first, I used to see people in their homes. Then, gradually, word got around, and every time I came, there was another woman who wanted to have her hair done. I did hair, including wigs and nails. The women got hold of the things I needed, because I didn't have a hairdryer or hair curlers, not even shampoo. Then, one day, the camp hairdresser approached me. He had his own salon, a man's salon, with two employees, and he asked whether I wouldn't rather work alongside him in the salon. He said he would let me have the two wash basins at the back. So my husband came with me once and fitted a curtain rail to the ceiling. We hung up a curtain so that the wash basins at the back were separated off from the rest of the salon, and that's where I served the women from then on. It meant I could do many more women's hair than before, when I still had to go round all the different apartments. I worked there 4 days a week. There was always plenty to do.
In the camp, some people had begun to set up small businesses. Trousers were manufactured here, for example. One person was in charge of cutting out the material. Another did the buttons and buttonholes. A third sewed in the pockets. And when everything was finished, the trousers were taken to be sold at markets. After a few years, some people were doing really well.
Soon after we arrived, my father opened a furrier's workshop in Munich. My brother worked alongside him in the workshop. That meant we no longer had to rely on the support of the relief organizations. However, it tore our family apart. For weeks on end, I didn't see my father at all. When we did come to Föhrenwald, the discussions always revolved around one question. When would we be able to leave Föhrenwald? For my mother, Camp Föhrenwald was simply a hole. She said my father had to get us out of this hole once and for all.
The parties were the best thing. Every Saturday, these lovely parties were held in a separate hall. It was always freshly decorated for the occasion and looked really nice. There was marvelous food, real feasts laid out on huge tables with pretty dishes and plates full of roast duck and goose, fish and cake. Everything was really fresh and beautifully prepared, cut into bite-sized pieces so that it was easy to eat. They were all such fantastic housewives, and they were always immaculately turned out for the party. The men in their elegant dark suits, and of course the women looked very elegant in beautiful dresses they bought in boutiques in Munich. Sometimes they gave me one too. Every Saturday they would say, "You'll be coming along again tonight, of course." I was encouraged to bring my husband along too. He was a good dancer and the women liked that. I always used to say to him, "You have to dance with her too. She's a customer of mine." Real friendships were formed during that time. Later, when they had long since moved away, many of these women popped in to say hello when they were out walking in the area.
The 30th of January 1946, Mayor of Wolfratshausen's report to the Chief Administrative Officer. The behaviour of the Jews is causing discontent. In the stores, they are very pushy and demanding. They want to get goods and foodstuffs without coupons. They offer colossal sums as money as something they have plenty of, and hoard goods in short supplies, such as salt and matches, in order to sell them off somewhere else. People's aversion to the Jews was not as strong before, when only a few irreproachable businessmen of their sort were active here, as it is now, when they reveal their true nature in masses.
In 1952, all the DP camps except Föhrenwald are closed. The DPs who have not yet immigrated are transferred to Föhrenwald.
The industry Verwaltungsgesellschaft leases the Föhrenwald settlement to the district government of Upper Bavaria as a residential complex for homeless foreigners.
30th of January 1952. Concerning dog license fee. Dog registration in the district government camp Föhrenwald. 40 dogs are registered.
District school from 1952 onwards. 3 classrooms, 1 assembly hall, 1 staff room, 1 Jewish and 4 German teachers instruct 130 children according to the German syllabus, with Hebrew as an additional subject.
May 1953, Süddeutsche Zeitung newspaper. District government camp for homeless foreigners. Föhrenwald, the waiting room of the unfortunate.
The 13th of January 1954, the Jewish people accommodated in the district government camp comprise the following nationalities: Germans, 103, Poles, 1,531, Romanians, 121, Czechs, 70, Hungarians, 98, plus 104 Jews from different countries.
In 1954, 2,027 DPs are still officially resident in Camp Föhrenwald.
At that time, you heard nothing but bad things about the DP Camp Föhrenwald. Now, you hear good things too, sometimes from people who were directly involved. Strangely enough, you didn't hear that back then.
The whole neighborhood wanted the camp gone. When the camp was closed, a fundamental decision was made that Jews would not be allowed to buy any terraced houses or properties there. I don't know whether any of them could have afforded to. For this reason, several families were moved out by force. They weren't asked, they were simply told. I know people who said they weren't going to leave, they were going to stay here, but they couldn't. The aim was to scatter them, to disperse all of the remaining Jews to Munich, Frankfurt, Düsseldorf.
The German administration had the task of closing down the camp. The resentment was so great that when the new director assumed responsibility for the camp, he armed himself with a pistol before entering the campgrounds. He never had to use it. If you study the history of the camps, you can see that there was no serious crime, only thefts and fights, but there were no robberies or murders here, even though people had been through such awful experiences. But the image of anti-social mobs was obviously so fixed in the minds of the German administration that the camp director had to turn up here armed with a pistol.
We had to move. First of all, we lived on Illinoisstraße. Then we were moved to the other part when the settlers came. The camp was divided into two halves because of the new settlers. The settlers were on one side and we lived on the other. With the arrival of the settlers, front gardens, flower beds, and vegetable plots suddenly began to appear. When the camp was closed in 1957, we were among the last to leave. The remaining families were moved to larger towns, and in this way quite a lot of people from Föhrenwald came to Frankfurt. From then on, two residential blocks housed Jews from Föhrenwald.
At first, it was a voluntary decision to move out of the camp. Every 4 weeks or so, a notice would be put up on the bulletin board saying that 15 families could get apartments and that applicants should register at such and such a place. In families where at least one parent was still alive, it was seen as an opportunity to get out of the camp because they already had been turned down 50,000 times. You knew you were entitled to public assistance and a public housing apartment. However, the government also knew that these people could no longer be accommodated anywhere else in Germany or abroad. The ones who didn't volunteer to leave were those whose mental and physical health had been destroyed. They had to be forcibly removed from the camp.
We heard that Camp Föhrenwald had been bought by the Catholic Church and that the houses were being sold off. We, the members of the Settlers Association, could not have built new houses as cheaply as you could buy houses in Föhrenwald. For this reason, we wanted to find out what this Föhrenwald place actually looked like. So one person went to check and came back horrified. He said he couldn't do it. His parents had been in a camp up until now as expellees, and there they would be yet in another camp.
We were one of the first families to leave Föhrenwald voluntarily in this way. On my mother's initiative, we moved into a public housing apartment in Munich in October 1955. My mother took me to school the very next day. The teacher was waiting for us outside the door. A tall, strong man, he welcomed me and instructed me not to tell anyone in the class that I was a Jew. I kept to that. For a very long time, I kept to that. Sometime later, during a history lesson, we were told that when the plague broke out, the Jews were blamed because they had supposedly poisoned the wells. At that moment, the whole class turned to look at me. I acted like it had nothing to do with me. So in fact, they did all know. But after all, my German wasn't very good, nor did I look very German. I had only had 2 years of German lessons in Föhrenwald. The little German we had learned was from a few classes in the camp school. We spoke Yiddish at home and amongst ourselves, and it was obvious when I started at the German school that I was the worst pupil by far. After a few months, the teacher asked, "So, who wants to go on to Gymnasium, to high school?" The only two pupils who put their hands up were the car dealer's son and the son of the bicycle shop owner. The teacher noted down the two names, and then he said to me, "And I'll put your name down too." The whole class turned to look at me. They thought he was joking. I didn't dare to contradict him. He was known for using corporal punishment. From then on, whenever the rest of the class had painting or physical education, he would call me to the blackboard and practice German and arithmetic with me. The entrance examination was to be held in June, and he said, "You're not good enough yet. Tell your mother she should report you off sick and we'll study during the summer vacation. I studied with him and his brother-in-law for 6 to 8 hours every day during the vacation. He never asked for money or anything else in return. At the end of the vacation, I took the exam and got a B in German and an A in arithmetic. So I went to Gymnasium.
1955 Building Management. The houses that were inspected in Föhrenwald and the houses detailed below have the same ground plan. Each housing unit has a full-size cellar. The first floor contains 2 living rooms, a washroom, boiler room, a spacious hallway, a toilet, and a urinal. On the top floor there is a room measuring approximately 40 square meters that is accessed from a 3-square-meter hallway. The housing units do not contain a kitchen, laundry room, or bathroom. Windows, doors, floors must be replaced, bathroom and toilet fitted, and heating installed.
28th of October, 1955, Isa Lozak Borte newspaper. New names required for the streets in Föhrenwald. Following the takeover of the Föhrenwald settlement by the Siedlungswerk, the main streets in the settlement are now municipal streets. They must be renamed because the names currently in use are quite out of the question, as are those which were registered when the settlement was built during the Third Reich.
On February the 28th, 1957, the last 800 Jewish DPs left Camp Föhrenwald.
1976, Isa Lozak Borte newspaper. The notorious Föhrenwald post-war camp had become the clean Waldram housing estate.
Memeler Straße, New York Straße, Rupert Straße, Danziger Freiheit, Independence Place, Kolpingplatz, Adolf Hitler Platz, Roosevelt Square, Seminarplatz, Sudetenstraße, Ohiostraße, Weldenstraße, Kärntnerstraße, Missouristraße, Scherstraße, Tirolerstraße, Kentuckystraße, Steichelestraße, Ostmarkstraße, Dr. Philipp Auerbachstraße, Bettingerstraße.
We settlers wanted a systemized settlement. We wanted there to be a certain uniformity about the place, a kind of model settlement. People came from all over Germany. The majority were expellees, including Hungarian Germans, for whom the housing situation was particularly bad. The families who came here were generally quite large. We did have families with 10 or more children. There was not one only child in the camp.
Föhrenwald was one big marketplace. I bought cigarettes here once for my father. But the settlers didn't want things being sold on every corner because Föhrenwald already had a bad reputation as a black market and a center for counterfeit money.
The impression given by the place back then was naturally not very inviting. The houses were totally run down, and here, for example, between what is now Korbinianstraße and Ruppertstraße, there was a huge dump. But by then, renovation work had already started around Kentuckystraße and Tenneseestraße, and that gave you an idea of what it might be like later. We didn't let ourselves be put off and acted quickly. Our names were registered as prospective settlers.
The fabric of the houses was good. It still is today. The buildings are made of solid brick, and the cellar is made of concrete and varying qualities. One of the rooms in the cellar was intended to be an air raid shelter, so it was made of the best quality concrete. They wanted to get rid of the camp, also for reasons of cost, and this aim is reflected in the experts' reports on the building structure. But in reality, it wasn't that bad.
The houses were all painted with camouflage paint, the roofs too. A spruce was fixed to the roof of my house. Later, I found out that means that Orthodox Jews live here.